studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Uprising, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. It's Thursday, June 25th, 2015. 6 months after the Senate Intelligence Committee released the summary of a report on CIA torture, there has been no accountability. We'll turn to former CIA analyst Ray McGovern. And part two of a multi-part series from Brave New Films as part of the Henry A. Wallace National Security Forum, I'll be interviewing Linda Bilmes on the costs of war. Plus, right-wing protests have broken out in Ecuador over a new tax law. My guest Amalia Payares will explain what's at stake. That's coming up after the news. Joining us now to analyze today's headlines is Robert Jensen, sitting in for Chenjerai Kumanyika. He is an author and a professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin. Hi, Bob.
Hello, Sonali.
President Obama has announced a major change in the way the government will deal with U.S. citizens who are captured by terrorist organizations abroad. After intense criticism from the family of those executed by groups like the Islamic State, Mr. Obama admitted that government policy has been detrimental to the well-being of hostages and their families. He said, quote, "There have been times where our government, regardless of good intentions, has let them down. I promised them that we can do better." Leaving in place the long-standing policy of never paying ransoms to kidnappers, the government will now not prevent families from trying to pay them. They will also allow communication between the families and hostage takers. The president was accompanied by the families of Kayla Mueller, Peter Kasich, and Stephen J. Sotloff when he made the announcement yesterday. Some European governments have ended up paying ransoms to ISIS in exchange for hostage lives. Well, Bob, this is a tough issue because we shouldn't fuel terrorist groups with U.S. tax dollars, of course. But isn't the bigger picture that is often missed in Washington, D.C., that U.S. foreign policy is what really fuels the anger of ISIS and other extremist groups?
That's always the appropriate response, I think. You know, there are problems, short-term problems, that really don't have good solutions, and this is a great example of it. If you pay ransoms, of course, you encourage more kidnapping and you fuel that terrorism. The real question is, why is the U.S. so hated in the Middle East? And the answer can't come in the short term. It's got to be looking back over 4 or 5 decades of really irresponsible policies and a commitment to changing that policy. So people say, well, that's all, you know, kind of abstract and theoretical, but it's very concrete. Statements by the U.S. government that it's going to radically change its policy in the Middle East would go a long way to undermining the support that does exist for these kinds of groups like ISIS. And I think that's where our focus should be.
And speaking of terrorists, just a week after the brutal massacre of 9 African Americans at Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, a new report was released on right-wing terrorism in the United States. New America Media issued the report entitled Homegrown Extremism, 2001 to 2015, and found that right-wing ideologues killed twice as many people within U.S. borders as those motivated by Islamic extremism. One Muslim spokesperson told the New York Times, quote, "With non-Muslims, the media bends over backwards to identify some psychological traits that may have pushed them over the edge. Whereas if it is a Muslim, the assumption is that they must have done it because of their religion." The report's authors used the commonly accepted definition of terrorism as an act of political violence against a civilian target by someone other than a state. And the report came on the same day that the Boston Marathon bomber Dzhokhar Tsarnaev was formally sentenced to death for his actions, which were considered terrorist. Last week's massacre by white racist Dylan Roof was officially deemed by the government to not be a terrorist attack. Bob, how important is this report by New America Media?
Well, for those people who care about the facts, it's very important. But, you know, here we're talking about rhetoric. So let's go back to a few key points. First of all, notice the definition excludes state terrorism. So the use of violence by states, including our own, to achieve a political end is sort of pushed off the table, and that's a serious error. But in the context of this, the terms extremist and terrorist can mean different things to different people. I've often been accused of being very extreme, for instance, in my hatred of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East or corporate capitalism. And in some sense, yes, I am extreme. But in the context of contemporary American political discourse, I don't think terrorist is ever going to shift to include the kind of right-wing violence you're talking about. So maybe getting rid of the term in this context is the best we can hope for. But it does focus our attention on the really violent nature of these kind of groups. And living in Texas, I'm very aware of it. It's all around me.
Right. Finally, a major lawsuit on climate change in the Netherlands may be a game changer for the fate of the planet. More than 800 Dutch citizens successfully sued their government for failing to protect their human rights by contributing to greenhouse gas emissions. A court in The Hague has ordered the Dutch government to cut emissions by a whopping 25% in only 5 years. The victory is major, not in terms of its actual impact, but in how it could inspire similar legal actions in other nations. Meanwhile, here in the U.S., the oil giant ExxonMobil has been forced to temporarily shut down operations at three of its offshore oil rigs after Santa Barbara County in California refused to issue an emergency trucking permit. ExxonMobil applied for the permit after a major oil pipeline carrying crude oil burst near the beach, covering sand and water with fuel. The spill killed hundreds of marine birds and animals. Bob, what do you make of the climate victory in the Netherlands?
Well, I think anytime climate change is in a headline, that's a good thing. So all of these fronts, whether it's activism in the street or lobbying existing legislative and executive branches or the judicial branch weighing in, it's all to the good. But we have to remember that the law is not going to be, I think, the vehicle for really changing policy on climate. And in some sense, the policy on climate that comes out of government isn't going to change without a real shift in underlying economics. And that brings us back to the kind of high energy lifestyle of the affluent first world. And that's where we have to continue to focus. So yes, let's keep on all these fronts, but let's not be, I think, lulled into a sense of security by actions of judges. That's not going to change the underlying reality.
Bob Jensen, I want to thank you as always for joining us today.
Thanks, Sonali.
Robert Jensen, sitting in for Chenjerai Kominyika, is an author and a professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin. This is Uprising. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. More than 6 months ago, the Senate Intelligence Committee released the executive summary of its investigation into CIA torture practices during the Bush presidency. The process of producing the report itself was highly controversial, with the CIA doing everything in its power to stymie the investigation, including spying on Senate members of the committee. The actual report itself remains classified, but there is now enough information in the public that questions are arising about why there has been no legal action taken. If the CIA has been documented as having tortured detainees captured during the so-called war on terror in the report, then why has the Obama administration and its Justice Department not built on the Senate report? That question troubled human rights organizations so much that several of them signed on to a letter this week calling on Attorney General Loretta Lynch to conduct a truly independent investigation and push for accountability for what was done. Specifically, the letter, signed by Amnesty International, the ACLU, and Human Rights Watch, calls on Lynch to, quote, appoint a career prosecutor as a special prosecutor to review the report and to ensure that there is a comprehensive criminal investigation into the conduct documented by the Senate torture report, as well as the authorization for that conduct. The letter was also signed by 110,000 members of the U.S. public. Joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst, whose responsibilities included chairing National Intelligence Estimates. He's also the co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Welcome to Uprising, Ray.
Thank you.
Now, the Senate Intelligence Committee's report was not the first time that there was an official inquiry into the CIA's torture, was it? There was an earlier inquiry in 2009 by Assistant U.S. Attorney John Durham, but apparently that was not a sufficient report?
Well, it wasn't sufficient. the problem here is that the President of the United States authorized torture. The Justice Department lawyers did a phony rationale for approving it, making it legal. And out of professional courtesy, or what do we say, honesty among, honor among thieves, not honesty, you have the other lawyers in the Justice Department that came in with Obama doing the same thing. So we know, in short, that on February 7th, 2002, George Bush authorized torture by exempting the Taliban and Al-Qaeda from Geneva protections. Now, that's on record. What they call this memo, it's 1.5 pages, and it's available in PDF form on the web. What they call this was a humane treatment of Al-Qaeda and Taliban detainees. But the operative sentence was, we shall treat them humanely, comma, as appropriate, comma, and as consistent with military necessity, end quote. Well, hello, that's not what Geneva says. That's not what the statutes against torture in U.S. law say. That's not what the Convention Against Torture says. And so George Bush did this on the advice of Alberto Gonzalez, his White House lawyer at the time. And it's interesting because the week before, or actually a little bit more than that, on the 25th of January, Bush's memo was February 7th. Here I have an operative sentence or two from Gonzalez. Quote, Mr. President, it is difficult to predict the motives of prosecutors or independent counsels who might in the future decide to pursue unwarranted charges based on Section 2441. Your determination would create a reasonable basis in law that Geneva does not apply, which would provide a solid defense to any further prosecution. Well, if further proof were needed, when the Senate finished a 5-year investigation into all of this, there's a subhead in their report, which was bipartisan, Chuck Hagel and Olympia Snowe having signed onto it. The Senate Armed Services Committee report said, Bush memo opened the door to torture.
Right.
So
right.
That's why they're reluctant to pursue it, because the highest people are involved.
Now, Ray, how important is the Senate committee report? If we only have access to the executive summary of that report, how useful has it been? And why would the Senate committee issue this report if they weren't going to act on it?
Well, there's a mixed blessing in issuing the report. You point out quite accurately that it's terrible not to act on it. But the terms of reference agreed to by the Republicans on the Senate Intelligence Committee, as well as the Democrats, was to pursue the question about what the CIA did and whether their claims that torture worked were accurate. Now, the only reason that the Republicans agreed to that was in the immediate wake of finding out that some 95 torture tapes showing waterboarding in Thailand had been destroyed against the admonitions of the White House counsel not to destroy them. So there was a fervor in sort of pursuing this, but as soon as it became clear that Dianne Feinstein had ordered her young staffers to do an honest job, the Republicans opted out. So now they can claim it was a partisan report, not a bipartisan report, but the reason is that they opted out. Now, Dianne Feinstein, to her credit, when she saw that the CIA had actually hacked the Senate committee's computers, and when George Tenet denied that and later had to confess and apologize, she was really in high dudgeon. She looked like a grandmother, right? She had these young people, and they had worked their rear ends off for 5 years. They came up with a credible report. She was going to make sure that eventuated and that came out before she left office. And she had some support from Wyden and from that fellow in Colorado, what's his name, Mark Udall, okay? Now, when Udall lost the election, he was free to do anything he wanted. He could have released the whole report. And using Udall's threat and her own insistence that this thing come to light, she went to the president and said, look, if I don't put this out, Udall's going to put it out. I don't know that for sure. That's my speculation. And the president said, oh, okay, why don't you put it out? But let John Brennan redact it to a fairly well. Well, he did redact it, but it is so heinous in what remains that it makes it very easily would make one ashamed to be an American.
Well, Ray, I want to quote Amnesty International Executive Director Stephen Hawkins, who said, the Senate report contains disturbing and previously unknown details about torture, and yet the Justice Department is keeping it unread and unopened. It is effectively handing a get-out-of-jail-free card to all those responsible for torture. The message to every would-be torturer is that they will get away with it because the Justice Department will turn a blind eye. And that's, of course, that hits at the heart of why accountability is so important, because it can set a precedent to at least ensure that it'll be highly difficult, if not impossible, to repeat such crimes, right?
That's correct. That's exactly correct. And I would point out that there's an amendment now passed by the Senate at the House, the so-called Feinstein-McCain Amendment, which outlaws torture. Well, hello. Torture is already outlawed.
Right. Right.
By statute, U.S. statute, by international treaty, by international law. So this strange amendment, in some bizarre way, gives sort of credibility so that it was okay before to torture people, and now it's sort of frowned upon. It's incredible. So, yes, this is a stain on our whole country, and the Justice Department will, you know, if you look at the last several characters we've had there, Ashcroft, Casey, Gonzalez, I mean, and no better, I insist, Eric Holder, who dug up a very curious legal theory to justify assassinating American citizens in violation of the Fifth Amendment. All these characters are you know, thugs in lawyers' robes. And we ought to recognize that, because unless we change that kind of thing, those people in the Justice Department who went after whistleblowers, who were going after Ed Snowden, who successfully prosecuted before an all-white jury the African-American case officer, Jeffrey Sterling, they are really poison. And the best vignette about that is when Tom Drake, after 4 years, Thomas Drake was a whistleblower with the National Security Agency. After 4 years of persecution and prosecution by the Department of Justice, he was broke, and he had a public defender. And when the case was just about to come to trial, the judge said, look, you Justice Department lawyers, don't you ever dare bring a case like this into my court again, based on not only flimsy evidence, but forged evidence. What they had done was seize some papers, retroactively stamped them secret, and said they found them in Tom Drake's house. So that's how bad they are. I don't know how you get rid of them, especially with this professional courtesy or whatever you call it, honor among thieves that exists in the Justice Department. But that's the case, and it's a really, really sorrowful time.
Well, Ray, let's talk about Loretta Lynch, because, of course, she is in power to do something about it. In this letter that was signed on to by human rights organizations and 110,000 others, is calling on her to take action. I mean, she seems to, just my initial impression, that she seems to not want to rock the boat very much, but she's taken a far greater interest in prosecuting FIFA officials in the world of international soccer for corruption and bribery than CIA officers for torture. Is that should we be looking at her priorities in that context?
Well, her priorities are set by the president.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I have no evidence that she's ever been interested in soccer before, but clearly she was told to focus on that and avoid all these very sensitive issues. Right. You know, I have to say, the President of the United States, Barack Obama, has shown very little courage. I would say, rather than a profile in courage, he is a profile in cowardice. Colonel Davis, who is in charge of the prosecution in Gitmo, in Guantanamo, and wouldn't obey orders from these corrupt attorney generals and the corrupt lawyers in the Defense Department at the time, he quit. And he comments, and I think it's okay to say this on a program like this, he says, you know, I can't figure out Obama. I was so enthusiastic about him, but, you know, somewhere between the Capitol and the White House on Inauguration Day, Obama's testicles must have fallen off.
Oh, now, boy.
That's a terrible thing to say, but I think he's afraid, Sonali. I think Obama is very afraid. He has actually reportedly said to a close group of well-heeled fundraisers for him, look, you want me to be more progressive, but you're forgetting what happened to Dr. King. Mm. Now, if he said that, and if he feels that way, it really would have been far better, in my view, for him not to try to be president.
Wow. Well, Ray, I want to turn to the actual people who have been the victims of our torture. Recently, a detainee at Guantanamo, and of course, we forget that there's still men who are imprisoned there, many of them on a hunger strike. One of them, named Mo'ath al-Alwi, released a letter that was published in the press just recently. Al Jazeera Nation published it. He's from Yemen. He was captured by the U.S. in 2002. I mean, that's 13 years ago. He's been held at Guantanamo without charges. And he wrote the most incredible, moving letter that really should be a stain on American conscience. Here's a quote. He said, I hear the war in Afghanistan is over. This war was supposedly the reason I remained trapped, rotting in this endless horror at Guantanamo Bay. I write this letter today to ask, if this war has ended, why am I still here? Why has nothing changed? He, in his letter, describes how he's being force-fed in a very violent way as he's on hunger strike, which in and of itself is a form of torture because that feeding could happen in a much more humane way. Have you seen this letter? And are we as Americans monsters to allow this to continue?
The monsters are in the White House and the Department of Justice. It's an incredible thing. I have been pointing out all year that this is the 800th anniversary of the Magna Carta. Now, those barons in England that faced down King John and forced him to accept habeas corpus, for example, which became, among other things in the charter, the basis for much US law and law abroad. So what should we do about the fact? Should we, instead of celebrating it, shall we have an inquest? Or maybe we should have an appropriate burial for the Magna Carta, because what's happened in this country, I'm really ashamed to say, has been a reverse of all the protections that were wrested at great peril from King John by those gutsy barons in England, and have been a big influence on Western law ever since, 800 years. So are we going to have a burial or a funeral or something? I suppose we should, to give it due respect.
In his letter, Mo'ath al-Alwi also made a really interesting observation, paying attention, I'm assuming, to the internal politics of the U.S. He wrote, I realize that U.S. police officers get away with ruthlessly killing black people all the time. I wonder now if the U.S. follows any rule of law at all, the Geneva Conventions or even its own constitution. Where is the freedom and justice for all that it so proudly boasts to the world? I mean, and that's, again, this issue of accountability. If the torture report by the Senate Intelligence Committee was acted upon, and if we, of course, freed all remaining prisoners like him and handsomely compensated him and others for destroying their lives, we would go a long way towards respecting the rule of law that we hold other countries to. I mean, I just imagine if this situation was happening in another country, the U.S. State Department would release some kind of scathing and judgmental report about how that country needs to respect the rule of law.
Well, yeah, that would be a mild response. We would probably drone kill whoever was responsible. Yeah, this really goes to such basic things here. People say that America's original sin is racism. I think that's correct. Okay. Now, we've seen it in this country. But do you think it would be as easy to torture people, to bomb the heck out of them, to drone kill them, if they looked more like most of us? I don't think so. Racism is at the bottom of that. Why do we call the Viet Cong, slopes, or we call them worse? Do we call the dissidents in Iraq camel jockeys or towel heads? Well, it's to demonize them. It's to make them susceptible to torture or to drone killing or whatever. So this is really very basic. And unless we address this kind of attitude, unless we treat all people as being created equal, as Thomas Jefferson wrote in our Declaration of Independence, unless we get rid of this notion that we are, as the president keeps saying, the sole indispensable country in the world, what does that mean? Well, by definition, that means other countries are what? Dispensable, right? That means other peoples are dispensable. And so unless we get rid of this attitude, and I dare say that the religious institutional leaders in this country are very much amiss in missing the opportunity to tell people that there's a moral way to act and there's an immoral way to act. I often say that I try to follow Jesus Christ, and he was tortured to death. Well, I was upbraided by a humanist friend of mine who said, look, McGovern, it's really nice to know that you try to follow Jesus Christ, but I'm an unbeliever. And I know that human beings don't do those kinds of things to other human beings. So it reminds me of Kurt, my favorite quote. He was asked, well, what do you think of Jesus of Nazareth? He said, well, I'm not sure he is God, but, you know, if it weren't for the Sermon on the Mount, I'd just as soon be a cockroach. All right? Well, I don't see that Jesus condoned torture in the Sermon on the Mount. As a matter of fact, he said something that's on my bumper sticker. I think when Jesus said, love your enemies, he probably meant not to torture them. Mm-hmm. Hello?
Well, those are good words to end on. I want to thank you so much, Ray McGovern, for sharing your insight and your humor and your wisdom with us. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Sonali.
My guest, Ray McGovern, is a former CIA analyst whose responsibilities included chairing national intelligence estimates. He is a prominent anti-war activist and co-founder of the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. This is Uprising. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. The issue of national security is constantly invoked by politicians and the media as justifications for war and surveillance. Since the September 11th attacks, the U.S. has launched endless wars that have ironically made us less safe and built an unprecedented network of intrusive surveillance. Today, as part of an ongoing series of interviews that I did with a number of experts, journalists, authors, and academics, we'll explore what the U.S.'s national security policies have really amounted to. The interviews were produced by Brave New Films, headed by the acclaimed filmmaker Robert Greenwald, and are called the Henry A. Wallace National Security Forum. Henry A. Wallace was the 33rd Vice President of the United States. He served under FDR during World War II and ran for the presidency on the Progressive Party ticket in 1948. He was an agriculturalist, an economist, an author, and a businessman, and was known as the champion of the common man in the struggle against the moneyed elites for control of government and the planet's resources. On today's episode of the Henry A. Wallace National Security Forum, we present my interview on the costs of war with Linda Bilmes. She's a lecturer at Harvard University focusing on public policy, budgeting, and public finance.
War is expensive, both in human and financial costs. But how much money are we actually spending? Welcome to the Henry A. Wallace National Security Forum. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. The financial costs of the U.S.'s wars are discussed in numbers so big, it's hard to wrap your head around them. And it's not just the cost of deployments and weapons, but the long-lasting costs of veterans' care that many policymakers don't take into account.
Linda Bilmes is the Daniel Patrick Moynihan Senior Lecturer in Public Policy at Harvard University and co-author of The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict. She now joins me to dive into these numbers. Welcome to the program, Linda.
Thank you very much.
Well, first, when politicians tell us how much a war has cost taxpayers, do they tell us everything? Are there hidden costs that we don't usually see in obvious ways?
Well, there are a number of ways of tracking costs, and what Congress currently votes on are simply the short-term upfront costs of fighting a war, so that means the military forces and weapons used at the moment. But there are very extensive long-term costs, particularly the cost of caring for veterans. And veterans' costs actually go on for a very long time. For example, the peak year for paying for World War I veterans' disability benefits was in 1969, and the peak year for paying for World War II veterans' disability benefits was in 1986. And the peak year for paying for Vietnam disability benefits, we haven't reached it yet.
There's also the costs of not just physical care, but mental health care, particularly when we know soldiers are coming home with intense trauma and incidents of PTSD. What about the cost of mental health care?
During previous wars, those who have returned have had mental health issues, and we heard about shell shock after World War I, for example. But what's different this time is that you have a much, much larger number of troops who are returning who are survivors. Roughly speaking, of the half of veterans who have come home and been approved to receive disability benefits to date, about a third of them have been diagnosed with mental health conditions.
What about the loss of productivity from disabled veterans returning home, both to the U.S. economy and also to individual families where a main income earner might lose their income because of disability?
There are many costs that are actually borne by individuals or by communities or by families. So, for example, many of those who have fought in the current Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts have been drawn from the reserves and from the National Guard. And many of these were self-employed or were mid-career individuals who had to leave their jobs. They came back over the past few years when the economy was very bad and their jobs were no longer there or their small businesses went under. Now, in the case of disabled veterans per se, those who are seriously disabled, in at least a third of the cases, there is an individual in the family, a parent or a spouse or someone in the family who leaves their employment or leaves their full-time employment in order to become a caregiver. And all of those are costs. They're real costs. They're just not costs that the government pays. And so the government doesn't actually calculate them.
What about the other aspect of the costs of war that aren't taken into account, which is increasing interest payments on the monies that we borrow to pay for war?
The question of how we finance a war is a very important question. In previous wars, as well as during the Cold War, taxes have been increased, and there have been a series of current use methods of financing which have contributed to the way that we've paid for war. In this case, taxes were actually cut twice in 2001 and 2003, very significantly at the same time that we invaded Afghanistan and then Iraq, and taxes have stayed low throughout the wars. So that means that the entire $2 trillion or so that has already been spent has been borrowed, which means that we have to repay that money with interest. And this is unprecedented in the history of the United States. The only time that we have actually borrowed for the entire financing cost of a war was during the Revolutionary War when the colonies borrowed from France.
Now, aren't we just passing on the costs of our current wars to the future generation?
Those of us who have not fought in the wars have not only not fought, but we also have not paid for these wars. So I haven't paid a penny of my taxes for these wars, and no one who is currently a taxpayer has actually contributed to the wars. We have actually transferred the full cost of these wars in terms of what has already been paid as well as what is owed in the future to the next generation.
So what is the difference then between the cost that we are told, say the Iraq war might have cost us, versus the real cost when you do take into account all of these numbers?
Well, if you look at the top line costs of actually fighting the wars up until now, it's somewhere between $1.5 and $2 trillion in the way that the government counts it. But if you include the long-term veterans' costs and economic costs and the structural increases in the Defense Department as a result of the wars, it's somewhere between $4 and $6 trillion.
Are there secondary impacts to the U.S.'s economy from waging the war that we're also not accounting for?
Well, there are several major long-term consequences, economic consequences, of being engaged in a war. And in this case, one of the consequences of the invasion of Iraq in 2003 was that at the time, oil prices had been stable at about $25 a barrel for more than 20 years. And the invasion of Iraq was one of a number of factors that contributed to a very, very rapid rise within 3 years of the oil price, which peaked 4 years later at $140 a barrel. And that incredibly rapid rise in the price of oil was one of the factors that contributed to the Federal Reserve increasing liquidity in the economy, which of course was one of the factors that contributed to the housing crisis. It's difficult to say that they're causal because there are many factors that are involved, for example, in the price of a barrel of oil. It's a combination of supply and demand. There are short-term and long-term issues. But there is no doubt that at the time that we invaded Iraq, one of the contributing factors to the very rapid price in oil was the U.S. invasion. And I think that the general transfer of a huge amount of resource into a war economy, of course, is less productive than taking $2 trillion and investing it in those things that have a greater multiplier for the United States, for example, infrastructure and education.
Now, let's talk about the military's budget. When the Pentagon requests funding, we get the sense that they never feel like there's enough funding, that the Pentagon always needs more funding. And yet, in those funding requests, we don't account for the hidden costs that we've just been discussing. How can more awareness of these hidden costs be a way to argue that we shouldn't be diverting so much of our money into wars and more into those constructive things you were just saying?
War spending is extra to the basic Pentagon budget. So in addition to the $2 trillion that we've spent on the war so far, and in addition to all of the accrued veterans cost, trillions of dollars that are still payable, we also have $1 trillion in the base budget of the Defense Department. It is very, very difficult to actually look at the Defense Department budget. It actually has flunked its financial audit every year for the past 20 years, and it's the only department in the U.S. government that routinely flunks its audit. So you can't really look at it in terms of the financial structure of where money goes. It also doesn't do a robust cost accounting, which means it's very difficult to untangle where all of the money actually goes in terms of the different activities, because the costs are buried in thousands of line items in a very, very large and cumbersome budget. At the same time, the Defense Department has actually advocated a number of cuts that Congress has not been willing to grant them. So you have the combination of a very poor accounting system, a very poor system of budgeting, enormous amount of complexity, a lack of cost accounting, and a lack of willingness in Congress to go along with cuts even where the Pentagon actually has itemized them.
Linda Bilmes, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
On the next episode of the Henry A. Wallace National Security Forum, Noam Chomsky will help us answer the big question: why does the United States seem driven to create an empire?
Expansion is the path to security. If you want to be secure, you have to control everything else. These are the standard views of what are called statesmen, people who are committed to defending and expanding powerful interests, powerful dominant domestic interests. That leads to the thrust for empire and the justification of that thrust as defensive.
And that's another episode of the Henry A. Wallace National Security Forum, produced by Brave New Films. My guest, Linda Bilmes, is a lecturer at Harvard University focusing on public policy, budgeting, and public finance. And next Tuesday, we will play the episode featuring my interview with Noam Chomsky on American Empire. This is Uprising. We'll be back after this break. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Since June 8th, the Latin American nation of Ecuador has been experiencing a wave of protests from people upset over new tax law. The law would implement an inheritance tax that would impact the richest 2% of the nation's population. President Rafael Correa responded by asking the following question on social media. How can we call a country a democracy if less than 2% of families own 90% of big businesses? But wealthy elites are up in arms, and to placate them, Correa halted the implementation of two other tax laws temporarily. Opposition figure Guillermo Lasso, who lost to Correa in the last presidential election, is one of the main leaders of the protest. He denounced Correa's tax plans as an attack on Ecuador's meritocracy, to which Mr. Correa responded, "What kind of meritocracy justifies the fact that in 2014, Guillermo Lasso earned $15 million, earned in quotes, which is to say the equivalent of 3,500 years of wages for a worker. How can that be morally justified?" End of quote. The ideological battle has been playing out on the streets of cities like Quito, where protesters and pro-government counter-protesters have been marching and rallying. On June 13th, Telesur reports that a group of pro-government protesters was attacked by opposition marchers, injuring the government's culture minister, Paco Velasco. Now there are calls for Correa to be ousted, with some on social media demanding a military coup. My guest is Amalia Payares. She is an associate professor of political science and Latin American studies and Latino studies, and director of the Latin American and Latino Studies program. Her books include From Peasant Studies to Indian Resistance, The Ecuadorian Andes in the Late 20th Century. Welcome to Uprising, Amalia.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Well, let's look at the detail of the inheritance tax law that has people up in arms. It would range from, I understand, 2.5% on amounts between $35,400 to about $71,000. And then it will go up to about 47.5% for amounts up to $850,000 and above. This is on assets and money that is inherited, not earned. Why is there such an outcry over this?
Well, I think there's a number of things. I think it's an outcry because there is a sector of society that is wealthy, but it also affects mid-medium-sized.
Amalia, we're having trouble hearing you. Could you take your headphones off and just talk directly into the computer? Yes, let's try that. Yeah,
can
go ahead.
Yeah,
I think that might be better. Go ahead.
Okay. So this affects also smaller businesses, medium-sized businesses that are family businesses are something that is not uncommon in the world. So this would be affecting not only wealthy individuals, but businesses. But I would venture to say that's not the only issue. There's also a tax for that sector that would, and for the middle classes as well, that would affect the middle classes. It has to do with, say, a tax when you sell over your profits, over the real estate that you sell. And that tax would mean that people might have to give as much as half of what their profit is on any house or building that they own.
Amalia, we're going to call you on the phone while we keep you on video to get a better audio from you, so do bear with us. Amalia Payares is joining us to discuss what is happening in Ecuador, a country that has been rocked since June 9th, or 8th rather, by protests from essentially the middle and upper classes of the country. And the country is headed by President Rafael Correa, who easily won his last election. And it is an ideological battle that's playing out. 5 years ago, there were fears of a coup. That fear has once more resurfaced. And there is very little media coverage of this issue. Amalia, go ahead.
Yes, I think that an important thing to point out is that this is an issue that has become important now, but there are many other issues and reasons why different groups are protesting, including Correa's desire to reelect himself, including problems with the leadership in the Galapagos Islands. So for many people, this is the tax is one issue, but it's not the only issue that's affecting a wider sector of Ecuadorians.
And so let's talk about the fact that there is this ideological battle. I mean, the opposition is calling it an attack on Ecuador's meritocracy. Is that a warranted statement?
Well, that is Guillermo Lasso's statement. And Guillermo Lasso is a wealthy banker who, by the way, has increased his wealth while in the 8 years that Correa has been in power. So it is not the case that Correa is new and just discovering this. I mean, a lot of people who are wealthy have been able to continue accumulating their wealth during Correa's regime. The question is sort of why is Correa doing this now? But I would say that this is not the only reason. It's not only meritocracy. Clearly, there is a sector of the right, and there are people who hold themselves as liberals who believe that people should be able to profit from what they make, that if somebody makes a certain income, their children should also benefit from it. But it is not the case that they weren't being taxed. They were being taxed, as you said early on. The question is, how much should that tax be?
What is the response from ordinary Ecuadorians, those who are not wealthy? Because, of course, this is being seen as a method of wealth redistribution. And, in fact, it sounds like exactly what it is. And I imagine those who are on the other side of that wealth divide are probably not seeing this as such a bad thing.
Well, I think you have to consider that some of them, the supporters of the regime, and some of the poor do not see this as such a bad thing if they believe and support the idea that what comes from these taxes will be, in fact, to redistribute. But in fact, what is happening is there's an increasing question as to whether it is only going to that, and there are questions about sort of corruption in the Correa regime. So I think there are sort of more concerns. But let me sort of remind you that there are workers' organizations protesting the Correa government today in Quito and in Ambato. And indigenous organizations have also protested the Correa government because what the government has done is also take away funds from the pensions of workers, from the pensions of teachers. All those recent provisions, which are considered more right-wing provisions, have been incredibly unpopular among the workers. And some observers speculate that is why Correa is now doing the tax measure, because the tax measure is more leftist and gives him more legitimacy among those who want to see him go against the property of the elites. A broader sort of question becomes sort of how is Correa going to continue to fund this state with the decline of the income coming from oil? And so that while he has taken away, workers' pensions and gained state control over those worker pensions, he is also now trying to increase his tax in order to be able to continue to finance his development program. So, yes, there are supporters, but increasingly you do see also opposition from the middle class and even from some of the poor. And you see that especially in organized sectors that the state has opposed, because the state does not like any opposition.
So essentially the pressure from below is coming from the left. Is that correct, Amalia?
The pressure...
I mean, it's not as though there are poor and indigenous groups wanting Correa to repeal the tax law. They just want him to actually...
No.
Right.
The poor and indigenous groups, I would say it's not just the rich who want the tax law repealed, it's also a middle class. The poor
do not want a constitutional reform that would make many of the poor, the ones who are concerned, that would make allow Correa to get reelected. And they are also very concerned, for example, the poor in Galapagos Islands are very concerned about the fact that the government is now trying to lower their living wages in the islands where the cost of living is much higher. And they have been able to get higher wages, both private and public employees, because they live in the islands. So there are very serious concerns about the poor. Right now, that opposition seems to be coming together in massive protests like the one that's going to happen today in Guayaquil, in my native city. So there are different issues. I would not say all the poor are incensed about the tax issue, but they are concerned about many other issues, and they do not want necessarily all of them to see a reelection.
What is motivating the Correa government to do what it's doing, if it has enough support from the left, from workers and from indigenous communities? Why is it lowering pensions, for example? Or is it that he's caught between the tensions with the middle class? Or is it simply that he might be more interested in power?
In order for the re-election, is that what you're saying?
Just in general, his policies. I mean, after his re-election.
Well, I think what he's concerned about is, I think, number one, continuing his state model. Generating enough funds. He has already owed about $50 million to China. He has sold the oil in advance for 10 years. The price of oil has declined. He has a state model that is based on a very large state expense, very large funds for state employees. And he's having a very hard time sustaining that model right now with the decline of oil and the debt that is owed to China. And I think his main concern is being able to maintain his model through cutting state expenses, cutting wages, and gaining more through taxes, taxing the rich more. So I think he believes he needs to continue to be in power in order to do this. The problem is that while for his first few years he had more support, there are questions about the sustainability of his model, number one. And number two, there are serious questions about the transparency of his model, the transparency of sort of knowing what he's doing with government contracts, privatization, the debt to China, and accusations of corruption, concerns about corruption in his regime. So there are, increasingly, even people who were more neutral, I have seen in the past month, have become more openly vocal and have become less afraid to be openly vocal because they are beginning to doubt his legitimacy and question whether he should stay in power.
Well, Amalia, I want to read for you the achievements that Correa's government says that they have had, and they sound pretty impressive. More than 1 million people lifted out of poverty. Education spending increased eightfold, an 80% increase in the minimum wage. 130,000 people with disabilities supported, with more than 70,000 entering the workforce. A strong economic growth of about 4% per year in GDP. A school attendance increased, particularly among indigenous and Afro-Ecuadorians. Health spending per person more than doubled, and 1.1 million hectares of forest conserved. I mean, that sounds pretty good.
I would ask you to look into those statistics a little more carefully. I would ask you to look at what happened with the Yasuni National Park, where that section of that park is being exploited, and it is against what his government claimed it would do. Those were the first uprisings that happened a couple of years ago, were around the exploitation of the Yasuni Park. Right now, there are different mining contracts with different countries that are also going to be affecting native populations. So I am not denying that there has been an increase in attendance in schools and that there has been an increase in the subsidy given to the poor. But the issue that I'm suggesting here is a couple of things. One is that model, where he has dedicated a lot of funds to that, was based on a very high price of oil, which is now declining. And so to sustain that model, where he's giving high subsidies and doing a lot of social spending, he needs to continue to have funds. He has already you know, loaned out our gold. England has the gold of Ecuador. Ecuador does not have reserves. Ecuador is in a terrible financial state right now. And he needs to generate the funds to continue that model. So I'm not necessarily questioning that that model has benefited some of the poor. I'm just saying that it's, the question is whether it's sustainable and what he has to do next in order to sustain it. And so what he has to do next in order to sustain it is what is causing the middle class who owns property, as well as the upper class who owns a lot more, to be very concerned about their assets. Because they have seen also how the workers' pensions and Social Security and all these things have been affected by his recent policies to try to get more, generate more revenue.
Although I doubt that, highly doubt that the wealthy would care much about workers' pensions. It's really not in their interests. I also want to point our audience to an interview we had done last year with Leo Cerda, an indigenous activist in Quechua, who is a member of the Yasunidos Collective, who has been very active on the issue of the Yasuni forest and keeping the oil in the ground. And certainly the Korea government has not been very good on environmental issues or indigenous rights when it comes to fossil fuels. In the last few seconds of our conversation, Amalia, what do you expect will happen next? Are the fears of a military coup overblown?
You know, it's hard to say. Korea has retracted on the tax law, as you probably know, and the fact that the protests continue is, again, I think, evidence that even though he has retracted on that for now, people are seeing this as an opportunity to maybe get a broader resistance. And, of course, the question becomes, what will the military do? And I do not outrule that if the military decides to oppose Korea, that you could see the possibility of a coup, but I would prefer to think of it as being, you know, at least some kind of peaceful resistance that leads to a kind of a serious referendum over non-reelection.
We are out of time. I want to thank you very much, Amalia, for joining us today and sharing your thoughts. Amalia Payares is an associate professor of political science and Latin American studies and Latino studies, director of the Latin American and Latino Studies program. And by the way, breaking news at the end of our program, the Supreme Court has just ruled to uphold subsidies for the Affordable Care Act. This is one of the very highly anticipated rulings by the Supreme Court. So we're glad to be able to bring that to you as this program ends. This is Uprising. Anna Buss is our assistant producer and technical director. Christian Beck is our production coordinator. Kiana Turner is our visual editor and audio engineer with help from Federico Garcia. Special thanks to Jonathan Alexander for technical assistance, and a huge thank you to Brett Collins of BC Life Communications. Annie Mendoza is our social media coordinator. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/uprisingwithsonali. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com. Our theme music is by Quetzal. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. I'll see you next time.